WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, filling in for Terry Gross. Shirley Horn was one of Miles Davis's favorite singers. She's become a favorite of many jazz fans. On today's Fresh Air, we feature a 1992 concert and conversation with singer and pianist Shirley Horn. She has a new recording out. It's called The Main Ingredient. And we'll hear from actor Nathan Lane. He co-stars with Robin Williams in the new film, The Birdcage. He played Nathan Detroit in the Broadway revival of Guys and Dolls. He was also the voice of Timon Meerkat in The Lion King. David B. and Cooley tells us about two TV shows which are making some changes to keep their viewers interested, and Ella Taylor reviews the film Chungking Express. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. The nation's fifth-largest cigarette maker has settled lawsuits with five states. The suits were trying to recover millions of dollars spent treating Medicaid patients with smoking-related illnesses. The Liggett Group has agreed to pay 2.5% of its profits every year for the next 25 years to the five states to help them pay Medicaid costs. Liggett will also create a pool from 5% of its income to pay any other states that seek Medicaid reimbursement, and it's also agreed to cooperate with pending state lawsuits against the rest of the industry. China will carry out more war games near Taiwan, but the White House is a little more upbeat. UPI's Bill Small reports.
Although China announced a new round of live-fire military exercises near Taiwan, the White House chose to focus on China's announced end to its firing of unarmed surface-to-surface missiles. Spokesman Mike McCurry calling it very significant, saying the U.S. had expected China to fire more missiles than it did and hoped the Chinese action would lead to an easing of tensions. He did not comment on China's announced intention to test fire an air-to-ground cruise missile, and had little to say about China's other announcement that its military exercises would now be extended beyond the date of Taiwan's first democratic presidential election on March 23rd, an action McCurry says the U.S. does not consider coincidental. Bill Small at the White House.
A federal appeals court has reinstated a tax fraud indictment against Arkansas Governor Jim Guy Tucker. The charge is connected to the Whitewater investigation. Tucker was charged with lying about how he'd spend a $7,000 federally backed loan and with trying to hide the value of a cable TV company to avoid paying taxes on its sale. The United Nations Secretary General has launched a multi-billion-dollar aid initiative to boost economic development in Africa. Boutros Boutros-Ghali's program gathers all relevant UN agencies. The initiative will be implemented over the next 10 years. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
The initiative comes against a backdrop of generalized economic decline and rising population on the African continent. It also results from the realization by aid officials that new ways of dealing with the problem have to be found. UN Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali.
Now is the time for the United Nations and the international community as a whole to stand together with Africa, its leaders, and its people. Now it is time for us to forge a new partnership.
The initiative aims to raise $25 billion, mainly from existing aid programs. However, officials declined to say which ones. So far, no new money has been pledged to the initiative. Nonetheless, African diplomats welcome the move because they say it focuses badly needed international attention on the continent. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
On Wall Street, the Dow is down 17 points. This is NPR. The government says inflation rose last month. The Labor Department says consumer prices increased 0.2% in February, just as analysts had predicted. They say warmer weather eased demand for energy. The consumer price index had jumped 0.4% in January, mostly because of high heating demands. French Prime Minister Alain Juppé, who's battling record lows in popularity polls, has launched a public relations drive to bolster his image. From Paris, Lynn Terry reports.
Alain Juppé has spent most of his time as prime minister holed up in his gilded offices in Paris. He's seen as being a cold technocrat, and his popularity ratings have been hovering around the 30% mark. At the bidding of President Jacques Chirac, Juppé is making an effort to change that image by getting out and meeting ordinary people in the countryside. In a visit to western France, he said that spring had arrived 1 month before schedule. While cuddling babies and visiting a housing project, Juppé acknowledged that his deficit-cutting drive was unpopular, but he insisted that it would pave the way for an improvement in living standards. Many French people don't see it that way, however. Unemployment has gone up in the past year and is now almost 12%. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
The Clinton administration is working swiftly to follow up on anti-terror initiatives announced yesterday by the president. CIA Director John Deutsch and Secretary of State Warren Christopher are in Israel, fleshing out a new agreement with that nation. It calls for pooling intelligence about militant Islamic groups and their operations. Deutsch and Christopher also worked out details of shipments of American technology that Mr. Clinton promised Israel. The Pentagon says wounded soldier Sean Austin is hospitalized in Tuzla, Bosnia, with a gunshot wound to the shoulder. The injury is not life-threatening. The Army specialist was patrolling a U.S. base when he challenged an intruder, who then shot him. The intruder got away. I'm Korva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. One of our favorite concerts in our archives is the one we're about to hear. Shirley Horn doesn't belt out a song. She has a small voice and an intimate style, and she's a terrific pianist. When she performs, every note and every pause seem perfect. Horn made her first record back in 1962. One of her first champions was Miles Davis. But in the late 60s, the 70s, and early 80s, Shirley Horn rarely performed outside Washington, D.C., where she's always lived. She stayed close to home to bring up her daughter. In 1988, she started recording for Verve Records, and that led to a comeback that has brought her international attention. Her new album on Verve is The Main Ingredient. In 1992, we invited Shirley Horn to record a concert and speak with Terry Gross. Performing with her in the studio are the longtime members of her trio, bassist Charles Abels and drummer Steve Williams. Shirley Horn is, of course, at the piano. Here we go.
Yeah. Let's take it nice and easy. It's gonna be so easy for us to fall in love. Hey, baby, what's your hurry? Relax and please don't worry. We're gonna fall in love. We're on the road to romance. That's safe to say. But let's make all the stops along the way. Shoo-be-doo-bee. The problem now, of course, is to simply hold your horses, to rush would be a crime. Nice and easy, does it? Nice and easy, does it? Nice and easy, does it? Every time. Let's take it nice and easy. It's gonna be so easy for us to fall in love. Hey, baby, what's your hurry? Relax and please don't worry. We're gonna fall in love. We're on the road to romance. That's safe to say. But let's make all now, of course, is to simply hold your horses. To rush would be a crime, 'cause nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it. Nice and easy does it every time. Every time. Every time. Every time.
Are we lucky or what? That sounds great.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you for being here. Shirley Horn singing, and at the piano, Charles Abels on bass, Steve Williams drums. Shirley Horn, I'm listening to you singing and playing piano and thinking, she almost became a classical pianist. Because you were a prodigy. You had a scholarship to Juilliard when you were young, which I think you never actually took.
No, my parents couldn't afford to. They couldn't afford it.
The scholarship didn't pay your living expenses,
no,
so you didn't have
it.
Yeah.
No.
Now, is that why you didn't become a classical pianist?
I don't know. I really don't know. I didn't know if I would have gone into jazz anyway. But then Earl Garner came along and he influenced me.
Did he come along in person or on record?
No, on record. He had a hit record. It was called Penthouse Serenade. And I remembered that. I used to sit with the record player next to me on the piano, and play his record over and over and over, and just copy him note for note. He used to drive my mother crazy, but he was like the beginning, you know.
Did you sing before you started singing professionally? Because I know you started out as a pianist. You didn't start singing as a performer till, well, a little bit later. I don't know exactly when.
Well, I sang in Sunday school and church, and but I was sneaking a job at a dinner theater in Washington, and there was an old gentleman who would come in every night, tip his hat, have dinner, and leave, right? And it was getting close to Christmas, and he came in with this teddy bear as tall as I. And for some reason, I just felt, I said, that's my teddy bear. It was beautiful, great big turquoise teddy bear. And he sent a note to me and said, if you sing Melancholy Baby, the teddy bear is yours. And I sang Melancholy Baby. You know, I knew all kind of songs and things. My mother is very musical. My family is very musical. And I heard the best music at home, you know.
So that was the first time you sang outside of church in public?
Yeah, I'm scared to death. But there was a woman there whose name was Clara Bow, an older woman who played and sang. She was terrific. And she sort of looked out for me. And she went to the owner and said, well, she can sing, so she's got to get more money. So I went from $75 a week to $175 a week.
Wow.
That was a lot of money then.
Well, that's a big jump, too.
Yeah. So I said, well, okay, I'll sing. You know, I never studied, you know. I just, I guess maybe listened to my mom, and that was it.
This would be a good time to hear you sing some more. Can I ask you to do another song?
Sure.
Great.
It had to be you. It had to be you. I wandered around and finally found the somebody who could make me be true. Make me feel blue. And even be glad just to be sad thinking of you. Some others I've seen, might never be me, might never be cross. Or try to be boss, but they didn't do. But nobody else gave me a thrill. Thank you.
all your faults, I love you still. It had to be you. Wonderful you. It had to be you.
Truly beautiful. We have Shirley Horn on vocals and at the piano, with Charles Abels on bass, Steve Williams on drums. Well, I almost feel like at a loss for words. It's just so wonderful to have you here. What I think we'll do is take a short break and then be back and talk some more and hear some more music with Shirley Horn. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring a concert today with Shirley Horn. She's piano and vocals, Charles Abel's bass, Steve Williams drums. You know, you were telling us before how you started to play after that whole melancholy baby story where somebody came in and asked you to sing. I mean, how you started to sing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I love your voice, and it's a very small voice, and I think some singers feel that to really sing, you've got to have like a big voice. Did you ever feel that way yourself? Did you ever try to push your voice to be bigger than it is? Louder?
Well, I'll tell you like this. I can scream. it kind of depends on the song, and the songs that I like, that I lean toward, are need a soft approach. There's some boisterous... I've done some singing, you would be surprised, you know. I don't prefer it.
Do you think of yourself as being shy as a performer?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And how does that affect you when you're performing?
I think I'm myself, you know, when I'm performing. I'm not a, you know, I've had the pleasure to go to listen to singers, performers, and they get on the microphone and it's all this blah, 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 talk and everything. You know, I came to hear you sing. Sing. You know, whatever you're going to do, do it, right? I don't think all that's necessary. I'm kind of a laid-back person. I've always been a little shy. Right, guys?
I take it you're not shy with the band.
Oh, we're family. You know what happens with family.
Shirley Horn, one of your first real champions was Miles Davis, and he, one of the last records that he made before he died was sitting in on one of your recent albums. He got in touch with you after your first record and asked you to sit in with him or to open for him at the Village Vanguard in New York.
No, he asked. I was in Virginia with my husband at my mother-in-law's table, eating all kind of good food and everything. And the phone rang, and I said, Miss Ollie, this is for you. I went to the phone and, Shirley, when I want you to come to New York, some people I think you should meet. And I said to myself, I said, who is this? It's Miles Davis. And I thought it was a friend of mine, somebody making a joke with me. And so I went back to the table because, you know, it was all kind of fried chicken and red-eyed gravy and buttermilk biscuits, and oh, boy. And I started thinking, I said, Shep, it's my husband. I said, I think I better go to New York. And I did. I called a friend of the family, met me, and we went to his house to let me know that he was serious. He had some young kids then, and they were singing, I mean, four, five, six like that. They were singing songs for my first record. So Yes, and I did meet some very important people with him.
Did he tell you what he responded to about your music?
He liked my use of space. And my chords, and the way my voice sings, and the way I played and sang, you know. Well, the use of space, you know.
It's an interesting thing for him to respond to, since he also used space.
Yes.
In his playing, yeah. So, did you remain close over the years?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We didn't see a lot of each other because he was very busy, you know, but toward the end we, in fact, just last year we were doing the same concert here at the Academy of Music, and we had time here, we had time in France.
Yeah, where you shared but the bill with him last year.
Yeah, yeah. And we were very close, spiritually. He was a great man. I miss him a lot. Part of me is gone with him, you know.
Yeah. I got to get back to your childhood when you were playing classical music.
Mm-hmm.
What introduced you to classical music?
My grandmother told my mother to give me piano lessons because I couldn't stay away from that piano. You go to my grandmother's house, she had a parlor. You know, that's where company went, and it was always cold in there. And she had an old upright piano. And I wouldn't go out and play with the other kids. I would just go and sit on it. And I remember putting on a coat always. And she had a stool, you know, wound up and down. And my grandmother said, told my mother, give me lessons. And so I had lessons when I was 4. I couldn't read or write. Other kids would cry and what have you when they went to take the lessons, and I always look forward to it.
Well, we have time for one more song.
Okay. What is it?
Fooling Myself is what you're going to do.
Okay. I'm through with you, and I'll have nothing more to do with you. I've ran away, but every day I'm just fooling myself. I tell my friends that I don't care. I shrug my shoulders at the whole affair, but they all know it isn't so. I'm just fooling myself. Every time I pass, I see my face in the looking glass. I tip my hat and say, how do, you fool? You've thrown your life away. I'm acting gay, I'm acting proud. And every time I see you in a crowd, I ran away. But every day, I'm just fooling myself. Looking glass, I tip my hat and say, how do, you fool? You've thrown your life away. I'm acting gay, I'm acting proud. And every time I see you in a crowd, I may pretend this is the end. I'm just fooling.
We've made today a very special day for us. I want to thank you so much for performing on Fresh Air. It's really been very special. Thank you.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
It's been great. And my guest has been Shirley Horn, who has been singing and also at the piano with Charles Abels on bass, Steve Williams on drums. And you can hear their latest records on Verve. There are several albums with the trio on Verve Records. So if you want to hear more, that's the place to go. Thank you again so much. I'm Terry Gross. This is Fresh Air. And can I ask you to play us out?
Our concert with Shirley Horn was recorded in 1992. She has a new album on Verve Records called The Main Ingredient. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, actor Nathan Lane. Before his role in the new film The Birdcage, Lane delighted audiences as Nathan Detroit in the Broadway revival of Guys and Dolls. David Bianculli will tell us how two TV shows are scrambling to please their audiences, and Ella Taylor reviews the film Chungking Express. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, in for Terry Gross. Although he's long been the star of the Hong Kong New Wave, filmmaker Wong Kar-wai has remained largely unknown in the United States outside of film festivals. His fourth film, Chungking Express, turned into a runaway hit on the festival circuit 2 years ago. The movie kicked around without a distributor until Quentin Tarantino picked it up for release under the banner of Rolling Thunder, his own distribution arm of Miramax Films. Film critic Ella Taylor has a review.
Wong Kar-wai can shoot high-octane gunplay sequences with the best of his countrymen. But where John Woo and Stanley Tong stick within the boundaries of the action caper, Wong's films are gleeful genre benders, pilfering from several and lingering with none. Chungking Express is a wildly romantic comedy about lost loves, chance meetings, and mixed signals. That's if you consider model airplanes, pink rubber gloves, and canned pineapple romantic. And you will once you've seen this movie, a giddy pairing of two tenuously interwoven tales about lovelorn policemen. In each story, the jilted cops, played by Hong Kong heartthrobs Takeshi Kaneshiro and Tony Leung, manage their grief by obsessing over household objects that stand in for the lives they led with the girlfriends who abandoned them. Meanwhile, each becomes enmeshed in ambiguous encounters with enigmatic new women who in turn give them the runaround. It's easy to see why Quentin Tarantino fell in love with Chungking Express. Shot for fun in a scant 3 months after the completion of Wong Swordsman epic, Ashes of Time, the movie is paced in part like a trashy B-movie, filmed with a frantic handheld camera and studded with fragments of American pop culture. The action revolves around the warren of multiracial flop houses, restaurants, and bazaars that make up Chungking Mansions, a block-sized tenement building in the heart of Hong Kong's tourist district, where the director's father once ran a club. At the center sits the Midnight Express, a fast food joint where the menu runs to chef salads and French fries, while the music leans to 70s kitsch. Here the cops, known only by their numbers, hang out and mope when they're not at home chatting to any furniture that will listen. At the Midnight Express, cop number 663 meets counter-assistant Faye, played by Hong Kong rock star Faye Wang, a monosyllabic elf who's mad about the mamas and the papas. Faye worms her way into number 663's apartment while he's away. She cleans and moves things around in a loving but ham-fisted attempt to distract the pining cop from the flight attendant who left him. Their cat-and-mouse game ends when he suddenly comes back, but when he finally stops talking to consumer durables and starts massaging her legs, she takes off for California. It's all completely goofy and completely touching, not least because the moody, lovelorn sections in the movie belong to the men and policemen to boot. It's women who quicken the pace, women who love and leave. Like Taiwanese director Ang Lee, who made The Wedding Banquet and Eat, Drink, Man, Woman, Wong Kar-wai is a wry, tender balladeer of the absurdities of modern love. Except that Ang Lee ends up anchoring his characters in the testy but enduring bonds of family. Wong Kar-wai's characters float uneasily in an urban world without anchors or boundaries. The only spiritual markers in their lives spring from a jumbled transnational pop culture heavily laden with Americana, which is why, unable to tolerate the uncertainties of life without discernible community, religion, or family, they build layers of spurious significance out of soap bars, dish towels, and stuffed animals. If you've ever had a heart-to-heart with a departed lover's toothbrush, you'll know just how they feel.
Ella Taylor is a film critic for LA Weekly. Nathan Lane has the kind of voice that screams New York. Here he is as the voice of Timon Meerkat from the soundtrack of The Lion King.
Hakuna Matata. What a wonderful phrase. Hakuna Matata. Ain't no peasant craze.
It means no worries for the rest of your days. It's our problem-free.
Now you can see Nathan Lane in The Birdcage, Mike Nichols' version of the French comedy La Cage aux Folles. The film stars Robin Williams and Nathan Lane as a gay couple. Williams runs a drag nightclub, and Lane plays Albert, his flamboyant companion, who's also the club's drag star.
Never mind about my feelings. Never mind about my suffering. It's just about your show. Not even our show. Your show. Well, I want a palimony agreement, and I want one now.
Well, I don't have a palimony agreement on me right now. Is tomorrow all right?
Don't use that tone to me.
What tone?
That sarcastic, contemptuous tone that means you know everything because you're a man and I know nothing because I'm a woman.
You're not a woman.
Oh, you bastard.
Everybody take it easy.
Whatever I am, he made me. I was adorable once, young and full of hope. And now, look at me. I'm this short, fat, insecure, middle-aged thing.
I made you short?
Nathan Lane's New York sound was perfect when he starred in the Broadway revival of Guys and Dolls. That role earned him a Tony Award nomination. When he left that show, he starred in Neil Simon's Broadway comedy, Laughter on the 23rd Floor. In movies, Lane played the gay next-door neighbor in Frankie and Johnny and co-starred with Michael J. Fox in Life with Mikey. Terry Gross spoke with Nathan Lane in 1994. Before we hear their interview, let's hear Lane's duet with Faith Prince from the cast recording of Guys and Dolls.
Serve a paper and sue me, sue me. What can you do me? I love you. Give a holler and hate me, hate me. Go ahead, hate me.
When
I
you
love
wind
you.
Wind up in jail, don't come to me to bail you.
Call a policeman. All right, already, it's true. So new. So sue me, sue me. What can you do me? I love you.
You're at it again, you're running the game. I'm not gonna play.
Was being on Broadway and Guys and Dolls everything you'd hoped?
And more. Was it everything I'd hoped? It really was. It was one of those times when everything sort of came together, and there were problems along the way, and I think it was interesting. We had a lot of time for rehearsal. We had about 7 weeks, and we didn't go out of town. And when you open in New York, you're really in a fishbowl here, and people, you know, don't wait. They like to go to the first preview and then get right home and call people and say, I hated it. And I think there was even more pressure. At first, we all thought, well, we're doing, you know, this classic musical. It's one of the best constructed and most beautifully written musicals in the world, and you know, but then you realize, well, all we can do is screw it up. So there is that sort of pressure, and everyone thinks they know how to do it, how it should be done.
Well, I knew how it should be done because of the summer camp production.
Right. Yeah. Everyone has done it. It's their favorite musical. So anyway, there was a lot of pressure, you know, people comparing it to the original, to the British production, or to their high school production. So
what would it take for you to cancel a performance if you weren't feeling well? How bad would you have to be feeling?
Cancel a performance? What kind of fascism is this?
Did you ever
There's
do it?
There's no such thing. Let's just forget you said that, Terry.
I mean, cancel you. I don't mean to cancel the whole show, but...
What?
You know
for
what I mean.
For me not to go on?
For you not to go on.
Well, I would have to be, you know, have no speech whatsoever, you know, if I had no voice at all. Or, I can remember, in Merlin, Merlin, the magical musical for the entire family.
The short-lived magical musical.
No, it wasn't that short-lived.
It wasn't?
I was there for 10 months, ooh, so that's not that short. At one point in a number, I stepped off a boat off stage and broke a bone in my foot. And I didn't have to go on for the rest of the first act, and so they took me to a dressing room, and they put ice on it, and they went and bought a crutch at intermission, and I finished the show, the second act, on a crutch, and then I went to the emergency room afterwards, and they said, you're going to be in a cast for about 6 weeks. So I called the producers and on Monday, and you know, explained what had happened, and Merlin was a strange show. It was, you know, these magic tricks surrounded by musical numbers. It was Doug Henning and Cheetah Rivera, and I played Cheetah Rivera's son because of our striking physical resemblance. often known as the Latin Spitfire of Broadway, Nathan Lane. And so I called them and said, I'm going to be in this thing for 6 weeks. You know, do you want to put the understudy on? Do you want to get someone else? And it was a show in which I had ad-libbed my way through most of it. I was kind of the comic relief in this thing. And so no one knew what the real lines were anyway. And so they said, no, we'd rather have you do it on crutches if you think you can do it. And so for 6 weeks, we were in previews for very long, longer than any show, I think, in history. When we opened, people thought it was a revival. Stop! You're killing me. So, and the show ran for 10 months, which just goes to prove that there's a lot of people in New Jersey. So I did the show for 6 weeks, and then I developed all this crutch business, you know? And then when my leg got better, I sort of hated to give up the crutches because it was a great... I got a lot of sympathy from the audience.
So you're going to go on no matter what. This is your answer.
The great thing about the show was they made you sign a release, mm-hmm. you know, not to reveal how the tricks were done.
Yeah.
And
you're here to tell
us
how. Well,
isn't this like the tags on your mattress? If you take them off, who's going to know? Or the police, the magic police, going to break in? Did you tell her there were two horses up against the wall? You know, I told everyone how the tricks were done. Two drinks, and yeah, I gave everything away, all the secrets. Well, Doug Henning has gotten out of magic now, you know. He opened that transcendental theme park, you know, Lazaland. Did you know that? You know, where you sit on a pillow and imagine you're on a roller coaster? Oh, baby, I'm cooking now. Oh.
You're killing.
I'm killing.
Actor Nathan Lane will continue in a moment. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Nathan Lane. Terry Gross spoke with him in 1994 during the Broadway run of Neil Simon's show, Laughter on the 23rd Floor.
So did the laughs come at the same spot every night, at the same places every night?
No, that's sort of the amazing and wonderful thing about the theater. It changes every night. And some nights it's raucous and it's amazing how a large group of people just take on a personality. And there was, like, last night there was a lady in the audience who was, I don't know, she was giving birth. I don't know what she was doing. She was screaming. She was doing her own show. And, you know, sometimes that's infectious, and sometimes it just alienates 1,299 other people. And sometimes they think they're being helpful, and they're not. And it's so weird because, you know, someone can cough on a key word and then the moment is gone or the laugh is gone.
Can you recognize personality types now by the type of laugh that they have?
Personality types?
Uh-huh.
Well, there's the coughers laugh. There's the guys that go, ha! Hooey! There's the people who want to know, let everyone know that they got the joke. Ah, that was good. Ah, oh, good. Yeah, I'm from Bayonne. I don't know what I'm saying anymore. People are funny.
Tell us something about your early years, Nathan Lane, the early years. You grew up in New Jersey. It's a good place to start. Tell us something about your family.
My family? Oh, my family is, look up dysfunctional in the dictionary. Their picture is there. They're all waving. Yeah. I come from, don't make me do this. Don't make me go there. Don't make me see the pain. My family is, I have two older brothers. What can I tell you about them? I was born and raised in Jersey City.
What did your parents
do
for a living?
Poor but boring family. Uh-huh. What? What
did your parents do for a living?
My father was a truck driver. My mother was a secretary and a manic depressive. And but really, manic depression took up most of her time.
Were you the wisecracking kid?
Was I the wisecracking kid? What do you think, Terry?
Oh, I think it's possible.
What do you think? Yes, I was the wisecracking kid. Yeah, well, what did Abe Lincoln say? If I didn't laugh, I'd cry. Yeah, my childhood was tough. My father died when I was about 11. He was an alcoholic, and actually my mother did go through manic depression for many years, but it made her a colorful character in the neighborhood. And then finally, she was put on lithium, that wonderful drug.
Yeah.
You know, that sort of balances you out. I always thought if I took it, would I become an accountant and move to Ohio?
Did it help
It's her? A joke, Terry. Work with me. Anyway, the family is very happy now. They're all fine now. And it was really my older brother, Dan, who got me interested in the theater. He's a teacher, and he would take his classes over to plays in New York, and he would take me with him. And that's how I got interested in the theater. And eventually I moved to New York and became a struggling, starving actor. You know, had all those, you know, strange jobs you have to do to
make
a living. Well, I used to deliver singing telegrams, you know. Happy hysterectomy, happy hysterectomy, you know, it was like ridiculous. And people hate when you deliver singing telegrams. And I did this for a very long time. Congratulations, Shirley, your stretch marks hardly show. And it was terrible.
Who wrote the songs?
They did. They would tell them whatever the occasion was, and they would put it, you know, set it to a popular tune, or, you know, one that was you didn't have to pay any royalties on. And then I used to sell TV Guide by phone. I used to do those surveys, the Harris Poll surveys. And what else? That was about it. I never waited on tables. So I just couldn't do that. I don't know why. I just thought of serving people. I don't know. I just couldn't do it.
I think your big break came when you started working with playwright Terrence McNally, who...
No, I was pretty successful before him.
Were you?
Sure, I was on Broadway with George C. Scott and Present
Oh,
Laughter.
Was that before that?
Oh, yeah. Oh. And I did a play with Simon Gregg called The Common Pursuit. And, yes, I had a television series. I know, he likes to think he took me out of the gutter. But no, I'd done a couple of things before I met him. But, yes, thank God I did, because... It certainly really did turn things around for me when we did a play of his called The Lisbon Traviata.
You've been in your share of flops, too.
Thanks so much.
You're welcome. How does it feel to be in a flop? Is it really, did you get really, really depressed and insecure?
No, you feel great.
You feel great.
Because, you know, there's nothing like living on the edge, knowing you're going down for the count. Yes, of course you're depressed. It's a flop. That's the big difference. If you're in a hit, you feel good. Flop, bad. Hits, good. Yes, that's what happens. You're depressed. But there's something, it's like being on the Titanic. There's nothing like the camaraderie of people in a flop, believe me. And I've certainly had my share.
Could you see it coming? The shows at
flop? Oh, sure. Sometimes the first day of rehearsal, you just look across the room and it all spells doom. It rhymed. Hey, I'm one of the poets you're interviewing. There's something, you know. I just saw this really strange movie the other night. I rented this movie because a woman in the video store recommended it. A total stranger said, "Have you seen Jennifer 8? And I said, "No." And she said, "Oh, it's brilliant. It's brilliant." And I rented it. And it was, you know, a bizarre movie. And this was sort of like a pretentious thriller. But one of my favorite line of the movie was one of the cops is talking about someone they're investigating, and he says, "I don't know, I sniff grief." "I sniff grief," he said. So that's what happens when you're in a flop.
Right.
Next time I'm in one, I'm going to say, "Hey, I sniff grief."
Nathan Lane spoke with Terry Gross in 1994. He co-stars in Mike Nichols' film, The Birdcage. And next month, Lane returns to Broadway in the revival of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. This is Fresh Air.
formalita.
This week, instead of previewing new shows, TV critic David Bianculli is taking a look at two shows that have premiered already and are making substantial course changes in an effort to find and please their respective audiences. One series is Stephen Bochco's Murder One, which premiered at the start of the season. The other is Dana Carvey's new variety show, which premiered early this week.
I'll start with the Dana Carvey series because its problems are more obvious. Critics didn't get advanced tapes of the Taco Bell Dana Carvey show, as it was called Tuesday night on ABC. But that just meant the series got roasted after the fact. Carvey is a very funny guy, but worked way too hard to be outrageous. In fact, the show opened with Carvey as a nurturing President Clinton, who took off his shirt, displayed his surgically applied rows of breast implants, and then had three puppies and a cat brought in so they could lick his breast milk. It was not at all surprising, but it was a little gratifying, when Taco Bell announced the next day that it was dropping further sponsorship of the Dana Carvey show. Carvey's original plan was to have a new sponsor each month, put its name in the title, and incorporate the sponsor's products into the show. It was supposed to be a joke about the way sponsors ruled things in the so-called golden age of TV. But the joke was on Carvey, because he may have trouble getting other sponsors to play along. In his opening show, this is how Carvey described his new series.
We're putting on a show that hasn't been seen in primetime in many years. It's going to be what Johnny Carson would say, a little irreverent, a little wild. And we hope that the audience embraces it and is ready for this kind of thing. It's really for my buddies at home that you guys, Rick and John, who my friends from high school have little kids now and can't stay up past like 9:30 or 10 o'clock. This show is for those sleepy little baby boomers who really want counterculture humor. Well, you've got it now, mister.
The problem is, what's acceptable in the last half hour of Saturday Night Live is a lot different than what's acceptable in the middle of primetime. Dana Carvey aimed for outrageous, so he shouldn't be surprised if the response was outrage. Watch him tone it down from now on, but this kind of initial damage is hard to undo. So is the initial damage done to another ABC series, Murder One. The network was so hot about that Stephen Bochco series at the start of the season that ABC scheduled it right against ER, the most popular drama series on TV. ER killed it. So ABC moved it to Monday nights opposite the CBS drama series Chicago Hope. But by then, the serialized courtroom drama of Murder One was so far along, most viewers were understandably reluctant to jump in midway through. Bochco and company made mid-course corrections to improve the show, including dropping the stupid, unrelated subplots that distracted from the main story. But no one seems to be watching or caring. 2 weeks ago, Murder One dropped its biggest dramatic bombshell yet and had the murder victim's sister take the stand as a defense witness, only to reveal she just secretly married the man she was supposed to give damaging testimony about. Bobby Phillips plays Julie, the witness, and Daniel Benzali stars as Ted Hoffman, the defense lawyer interrogating her.
Were you having dinner at Citrus last year when a man threw a drink in Richard Cross's face?
Yes.
Subsequent to that incident, did Mr. Cross telephone Rusty Arnold?
Yes.
And the following day, were you informed that the man in question had suffered a fractured skull?
Your Honor, objection. This whole line of questioning is irrelevant.
Overruled. You may answer, Miss Costello.
I don't think I'm supposed to, Judge.
I just made my ruling. You are required to answer.
But isn't there some law about testifying against your husband?
Excuse me?
Richard and I were married night before last in Reno.
If Murder One had the audience of ER, everyone would be buzzing about that scene the next day. But there's been no buzz at all, and that ought to start ABC buzzing with concern. At the start of the season, Bochco was talking about the intricate plans he had in place to keep the season-ending trial verdict a secret. With only a half dozen episodes left to go in this storyline, it looks like that job may be way too easy. When nobody wants a secret, keeping it is a piece of cake. Bochco can blame ABC's stupid scheduling for what's happening to his show, but Dana Carvey will have no one to blame but himself.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Fresh Air senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Nate Hardy is our intern. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moskowin.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House, publisher of The Ends of the Earth, a journey at the dawn of the 21st century by Robert D. Kaplan, author of Balkan Ghosts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.